Hello there. Today is Wednesday, December the 6th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump is expected to make a controversial announcement that could impact Middle East peace.
Well, I think it's very possible that there will be demonstrations, not only in the Middle East, but possibly across the Muslim world.
Why so many Americans feel like the system is rigged, how a huge merger could change healthcare in the United States, and an American pop star making a comeback after a major health scare. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump has been telephoning several Middle East leaders ahead of an expected announcement as early as Wednesday that the United States will recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. There was no immediate word from the White House on the substance of the conversations, but the Palestinian press reported that Trump had confirmed to Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas that the recognition of Jerusalem would be forthcoming. Arab and Muslim states have warned that such a declaration could destroy U.S. efforts to reach an Arab-Israeli peace agreement. Joining us now is Professor Amin Saikal, director of the Center for Arab and Islamic Studies at the Australian National University. So, Professor, how will this impact Middle East peace?
Well, it's certainly not going to really help the process of a peaceful settlement of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. If anything, it's going to fuel it further. I mean, the Palestinians will certainly react, and that may well result in more clashes between the Palestinians and the Israeli forces, and as a result, probably higher Palestinian casualties. It may even trigger off a third intifada, that is the Palestinian uprising. In the meantime, it will certainly play into the hands of all these extremist Muslim groups, because Muslims regard East Jerusalem as the third holiest site of Islam after Mecca and Medina. Mm-hmm. So that will really antagonize not only many Muslims around the world, but also provide further ammunition for these extremist groups to say that no, the United States has backed Israel in taking over their third holiest site.
Would you say that that would leave the U.S. out as a neutral negotiator going forward?
Absolutely. I think the U.S. decision will go against the United Nations position, which recognizes East Jerusalem as an occupied territory. And, of course, it will also go against the verdict of the International Court of Justice, which recognizes East Jerusalem as the occupied place.
Do you expect that we may see some immediate repercussions in the form of violence over there in the Middle East or elsewhere?
Well, I think it's very possible that there will be demonstrations not only in the Middle East, but possibly across the Muslim world. And we know that Israelis have already put their security forces on alert because they are expecting that there will be demonstrations and protests on the part of the Palestinians. And, of course, the Palestinians do have a lot of sympathy, not only in the region, but also around the world. Let's not forget that the world of public opinion has shifted very dramatically in support of the Palestinian cause. The President Trump's recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel would just simply result in further isolation of not only Israel, but also the United States and world politics.
Would there be any other nation in the world besides Israel that would be pleased with President Trump's decision?
Well, there may be, you know, a couple of small islands, like Marshall Islands, which they have in the past supported the American position. But I doubt it very seriously that there will be any other major country to come out and support the president's decision on this issue.
All right. That's Professor Amin Saikal, director of the Center for Arab and Islamic Studies at the Australian National University. Here are some of the stories we're following. At VOAnews.com, Russia has been banned from the 2018 Winter Olympics. The UN is deeply concerned about Yemen's political and humanitarian crisis. An emergency has been declared as wildfires rage near Los Angeles. And the Trump travel ban takes full effect, at least for now. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at VOAnews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, there's been a lot of talk in the United States about the rich versus the poor, who tax cuts will benefit, why there's so much disparity in our economic system, and why some in America that once made America strong by some accounts is failing. A new film on Netflix talks about this and how it can be fixed. Joining us now to talk more about his new documentary, Saving Capitalism, is Robert Reich, former U.S. Secretary of Labor under President Bill Clinton. Sir, thank you for being with us. The film really paints a picture of a society, whether we're talking jobs, healthcare, wages, really just based on abuse of power and pretty much every part of our economy. Has it always been this way?
The big change actually occurred around 1980. That's when wages began flattening most Americans, and it required two wage earners for most families to make ends meet, and many people without college degrees found themselves on a downward escalator. And since then, that's been the case. What happens when you have so many people who are so frustrated, can no longer get ahead, they suspect that their children are not going to do as well as they are doing, is you invite one of two responses. And this is true of many nations. It's not just the United States. You either invite fundamental reform of the economic and political system, or you invite a kind of strongman, kind of a demagogic response in which somebody uses scapegoats, blames minorities or immigrants or some other group for all of the problems that are experienced by most people in society.
As you put it in the film, incomes go to the top, so does political power to influence. And where does that leave the little guy? Does it allow for aspirations of the middle class to actually have any hope?
What leaves most people with is a sense that the game is rigged. And that's why in the 2016 election in the United States, you had Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders in the Democratic primaries all talk about the game being rigged, deck being stacked in favor of the rich. When you have a situation in which most people think that the political and economic system is rigged, then you're sort of inviting, again, either fundamental reform or demagoguery. And what we have in the United States now, and this has particularly been after the financial crisis of 2008, where millions of people lost their homes or their savings or their ability to just move forward, you get a kind of cynicism and bitterness that sets in. And unless that cynicism and bitterness can be put to positive use and turned into positive energy in terms of reforming a system, making the system more democratic, working better for most people, then you get people who are willing to follow demagogues who don't care about democracy at all and are very, very willing to scapegoat.
Well, you talk about the widening inequality and how it's just become so baked into the free market itself. And as you mentioned, there is a lot of anger and disillusionment. Is there turning back at this point?
There absolutely is. I mean, if you look back at the 1880s, 1890s in America, the so-called Gilded Age of robber barons, huge gaps between the wealthy and everybody else, a great deal of corruption. You had a situation that in many ways was much, much worse than we have now. America, though, is very resilient, and we tend to reform ourselves when the going gets very, very bad, and that's exactly what happened starting in 1901 with Teddy Roosevelt, a Republican progressive reformer who led the way to political changes, limiting the amount of money that could be in elections, busting up the big concentrations of wealth in the form of monopolies and trusts, anti-monopoly laws, and basically making the system start to work for everyone rather than for a privileged few. I'm also optimistic because I see all around me at the grassroots levels, and this was true when I went out in 2015 and 2016, even before the 2016 election, a great deal of grassroots progressive energy, people who are tired and angry of crony capitalism and do want to reform the system. In the movie, I talk with a fellow named David Bratt, who's a congressman from Virginia, one of the two most conservative Republicans in Congress, according to the Conservative Digest. And yet his main concern is exactly the same as mine, and that is big money that corrupts politics, that creates a democracy that is generating crony capitalism. capitalism, corporate welfare, benefits for the few rather than for the many who are already very, very privileged. And this is a bipartisan movement at best. I think it will be.
What about the GOP tax plan?
The tax plan is a travesty in that every analyst and almost every economist concludes that it benefits the wealthy, that it raises taxes either immediately or eventually on the middle class, that it adds at least $1.5 trillion to the national debt, which is already very, very high, far too high, and that it really hurts the poor, particularly the Senate plan, which ends the mandate for getting insurance in the Affordable Care Act. And this is not just Democrat or Republican. Many of these are conservative groups that have analyzed the plan and have come to the same conclusion. I've never seen a tax plan that has as broad-based consensus that it's actually bad.
It's certainly being sold as something that's going to really be a big favor for the American people, or as the president likes to say, a Christmas present.
Well, it's anything but. And you have some very powerful forces, particularly donors, particularly to the Republican Party, who have looked at this tax plan. This is what they want. This is why they invested in politics in the first place. They want their taxes cut. And I can't blame them in the sense that people obviously would like their taxes cut. They would like to pay less. But from the standpoint of just basic social responsibility and what we call patriotism in its best sense, it seems to me that this is not right, that people, particularly big corporations and executives and Wall Street and very wealthy people, should not be lobbying to get tax cuts when the result of those tax cuts is either going to be major deficit increases, debt increases, or a combination of debt increases and also cuts in services that people depend on, and increases in the taxes for everybody else. That's just not my definition of patriotism.
Well, I enjoyed the film, and pretty good dancing there at the end. You got a lot of rhythm, and I thought it was a nice way to lighten the mood.
Well, we needed that, I think. I just wanted to do a little dance. I love dancing, and I also thought that I wanted to end with an optimistic note. At the end of the movie, there are a lot of people who are determined to change the situation. A lot of Americans at the grassroots who are committed to changing it, and they're not just liberals and they're not just Democrats. These are people across the board, and that's something to dance about.
All right, U.S. Secretary of Labor under President Bill Clinton, Robert Reich, we greatly appreciate your time. One of the biggest U.S. drugstore chains, CVS Health Corps, announced this week that it's agreed to acquire Aetna, one of the biggest U.S. health insurers, seeking to tackle soaring health care spending through lower-cost medical services and pharmacies. That deal would let CVS position itself as a one-stop shop for America's health care needs with prescription drugs, clinics, and insurance plans. And joining us now to understand why this is getting so much attention is Len Nichols, Director for the Center for Health Policy Research and Ethics at George Mason University. So why is this such a big deal?
It's a big deal because of the size of the companies involved. But second, it's really a big deal because it's almost like man bites dog. Here's a drugstore buying an insurance company. You know, when America was great before, insurance companies were way bigger than drugstore companies. How did this happen? So how can a drugstore company be big enough to buy an insurance company? In fact, a major international insurance company. Well, the answer is it's not your mom and pop pharmacy here. CVS is the largest chain, but probably even more importantly, CVS Caremark, they are a pharmacy benefit manager for insurers. They actually negotiate drug prices against manufacturers of drug companies of drugs on behalf of employers and insurers. So they have come to learn a lot about what you might call supply chain management on the pharmaceutical side. And because they sell retail drugs at such scale, they have a pretty good sense of how modern healthcare is delivered because, as you know, pharmaceuticals are a much more important part of that than they were historically. And I think it's fair to say they have a number of these little minute clinics, the kind of places where you can get sort of retail primary care quick and cheap and, you know, sort of slam bam just the facts. And that kind of small clinic that serves a need for people who want straight primary care with no frills, I think they see that becoming, in a sense, a window into an evolving health care organization, which can be a one-stop shop for insurance products, pharmaceutical product, and your traditional complementary products that go in the drugstore.
What do you think that this deal means for the future of healthcare in general?
Well, for one thing, it does kind of signal that insurers are not the biggest kids on the block anymore. And that, in and of itself, is a fascinating turn. But for another, it signals a different approach to integration. Instead of insurers acquiring hospitals and doctors, as in the Kaiser model, or hospitals developing their own insurance product, which has happened in various places, this is a retail pharmacy company that also has become this large pharmacy benefit manager for insurers and for employers. That company is now acquiring insurance and diversifying its portfolio from what used to be seen as kind of a in-game retail satellite outlet. Now it's gotten so big, it's taken over the big payer for the whole system. So it's quite an interesting twist on an avenue toward what everybody's looking for, which is how to align incentives and deliver more value for all customers across the board. And if you think about it, what CVS seems to believe is that by acquiring Aetna, they may learn some things, by the way, about analytics that'll be useful for them. Aetna has a very sophisticated data analytics shop. And they might also learn some things about how pharmacy and healthcare delivery in general interact, and therefore they might be able to generate both care delivery and customer service efficiencies and value that would be appealing. I would say it makes everybody think, it's almost like a Rubik's Cube shift. Mm-hmm. It makes everybody think differently about the way alliances and integration can occur.
So overall, in your professional opinion, do you think it's a good thing?
Absolutely. I don't think there's anything wrong with it. I mean, I certainly don't see an antitrust problem. And what I would say is it's shaken up a system that's sort of not perfect, so why not?
All right. That's Len Nichols, Director for the Center for Health Policy Research and Ethics at George Mason University. We appreciate it. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
Hi, this is Lori London. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts. Every hour, on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information. VOA's International Edition continues now as we turn to the latest on what's trending in social media. We're joined by VOA's Andrew Palchewski. Hey, Andrew, so what's happening?
Well, Lori, yesterday we talked about Facebook Messenger Kids and how Facebook is introducing this new version of their Messenger app for kids 6 to 12 to try to get them online and, in theory, get them to become Facebook customers once they turn 13 and can get a Facebook account. Well, today we have another story of a social network trying to get more people online, but not maybe for those reasons of trying to hook people when they're young, actually trying to expand access. Twitter has announced that they are rolling out something called Twitter Lite to about 24 countries around the world, including Bangladesh, Brazil, Egypt, Mexico, Malaysia, Nigeria, South Africa, Thailand, and Tanzania.
Really?
Among those dozens of countries. That Twitter Lite app will allow users to access Twitter if they have limited cell service by limiting data and paring down some of Twitter's flashier features. The idea being that you can make Twitter more available to people in developing countries where
the
cell network...
the same type of internet
Exactly.
Capability.
Now, of course, Twitter is very popular in the U.S., but less so in other countries. So there may be that kind of same strategy that Facebook was using with their Facebook Messenger for Kids, that Twitter with Twitter Lite will get more people to use the social network. But they say it's not just that, it's also trying to bring in different countries and communities into Twitter to make it more diverse and to give more voices role and chance to speak out on social media. So this is rolling out currently. They plan to roll it out in even more countries. We'll see how it works out and if it gets used once it is rolled out.
Okay, so I understand you've got some news about Google.
Yes, so Google is one of the many tech companies that have been targeting terrorist and extremist content online. This is something we've been talking about for months.
Mm-hmm.
Facebook, Twitter, mm-hmm. Google, Microsoft have mm-hmm. all been cracking down on people trying to use their networks, their websites to recruit and spread extremism. So today, Google has announced that by 2018, it is planning to increase its efforts in a very big way. They said by 2018, they're committing 10,000 staff members to their counterterrorism efforts on YouTube, which is, of course, owned by Google. Those staffers are going to weed out any kind of extremist content and prevent it from being posted and shared on YouTube. Additionally, they're going to employ machine learning to develop algorithms that will find and block terrorist content. So as these people are doing this, the machines are going to learn from them. Now, if that sounds familiar, that's because Facebook announced last week that they're doing a similar thing, that they're going to use artificial intelligence and machine learning to try to block content before it can even be flagged by people. So this is all part of how tech companies now are using not just their people power, but their technology power to help them police content.
Well, I mean, terrorists are using tech, so
why not the tech companies?
Right.
And the tech companies are the ones who are developing these kind of things. They're at the crux of technical innovation there in Silicon Valley. So why not use it to do some good? And indeed, that is what they're doing.
All right, Andrew. Thanks.
Thanks, Lori.
And you can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Well, a singer who's battled health problems is getting some recognition in London. VOA's Border Crossings host Larry London joins International Edition's Sarah Williams with details.
Well, we're going to talk about Selena Gomez with Marshmallow and a brand new song that she's got out right now, just released, that she has been performing regularly. She did it at the American Music Awards show a few weeks ago, and she did it on Tuesday night at the British Fashion Awards held in London. And one thing that was interesting about Selena and her appearance at the Fashion Awards, she changed her outfit 6 times.
My goodness.
And one of those, of course, was for the performance, but the other 5 times was just for interviews and just to be seen at the Fashion Awards in the UK. Now, Selena Gomez began her career when she was about 6. She performed on a TV show called Barney and Friends with her friend Demi Lovato. She went on to star in Disney's Wizards of Waverly Place. And Selena now walking around with a blonde hairstyle. That's her new look. She just colored her hair blonde. And she's been talking a lot about getting the Woman of the Year award from the Billboard Women in Music honors that she received last week. When she was on stage, she was presented the award by Elle Fanning. She was on stage with her best friend, Francia Raissa. And Selena cried for a bit. She said, "To be honest, I think Francia should be getting this award because she saved my life." Now, you may recall back in July, Selena Gomez had a kidney transplant. She was near death due to the lupus disease that she has, and she needed a kidney transplant. So her friend, Francia, donated her kidney. So congratulations to Selena Gomez on the Woman of the Year honor. Now she joins Taylor Swift, Pink, Fergie, Beyonce with that special honor. Time magazine also put her in their issue of women who are changing the world. In fact, she was on the cover of that issue. So she's had a great year this past year. Just signed a contract with Puma for $20 million to create a line of Puma athletic wear and active wear. That's on top of the $10 million she already gets from Coach handbags and the money she gets from Pantene shampoo and the other endorsements she's doing. So let's check out Wolves, Selena Gomez, and Marshmallow.
In your eyes, there's a heavy blue. One to love and one to lose. Sweet divine, the heavy truth. Why do I want? Don't make me choose. I wanna feel the way that we did that summer night.
Well, does she have a new album coming in?
The answer to that is a resounding no. Selena Gomez is not working on an album. Right now, she's kind of in singles mode. And that's what she's been doing this past year, is putting out singles. And they've all done very well for her, Fetish and Bad Liar and Hands to Yourself. You know, she just keeps on putting out singles. The reason she doesn't want to do an album is she's not ready to commit to a tour because of her health. And usually with an album, you then have to go on tour as well to promote the album. But her singles are doing so well for her, and her career has done great. There's a lot of people that are saying that Selena seems to have lost her spark for music. Could be the health factor. Could be a lot of other things that are going on. She's now turned her attention towards acting and recently appeared in the new Woody Allen film, which is called Wonder Wheel, with Justin Timberlake and Kate Winslet, that's coming out in 2018. But musically, she's won 16 Teen Choice Awards, American Music Awards, American Latino Media Arts Awards. She's won all kinds of awards. She's definitely a superstar. And of course, we've been reading lately that she has reunited with Justin Bieber. And we're not sure about the extent of their relationship because they didn't spend Thanksgiving holiday together. And yet they have been seen out and about looking very cozy. So we're not really sure if they have gotten together. She was with The Weeknd for a while. And during the Billboard Awards, she said, "Isn't it great that The Weeknd and I can still remain best friends?" Well, The Weeknd took all her photos off his Instagram account.
Oh, my.
And unfriended her. Oh, so dear. Maybe he doesn't share that sentiment. But yeah. Nonetheless, Selena Gomez.
That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings. I've been running through the jungle. I've been running with the wolves to get to you.
You've been listening to International Edition. That'll do it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The UN Security Council convened an emergency meeting on North Korea November 29th, the ninth such meeting this year, after the DPRK launched its highest and longest ballistic missile to date, demonstrating the regime's relentless determination to illegally pursue nuclear weapons and the means to deliver them. U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations Nikki Haley warned that the international community has reached a critical decision point. She praised the Council's unprecedented measures to try to stop North Korea by deeply cutting into its major export industries and by reducing its military access to the refined petroleum that fuels its war machine. She noted that many nations have taken other strong actions, like restricting or ending diplomatic relations, cutting military ties, and severing trade connections. But it has not been enough to change the North Korean behavior. Some countries continue to fund North Korea's nuclear program by violating UN sanctions or by failing to implement them fully. Ambassador Haley says the time of reckoning has come. To ensure a peaceful reckoning, all countries should sever diplomatic relations with North Korea, cut off trade by stopping all imports and exports, and expel all North Korean workers. Also, Ambassador Haley said, China should stop supplying crude oil to the DPRK as it did in 2003, where, soon after, North Korea came to the negotiating table. Extreme options to deal with North Korea's nuclear threat include rescinding its UN voting rights. Many countries have made big economic and political sacrifices by cutting ties with North Korea. They did that to serve the peace and security of all of us, said Ambassador Haley. We now turn to Chinese President Xi to also take that stand. North Korea's latest ballistic missile test brings the world closer to war, not farther from it, said Ambassador Haley. We have never sought war with North Korea, and still today we do not seek it. If war does come, it will be because of continued acts of aggression by North Korea. And if war comes, make no mistake, the North Korean regime will be utterly destroyed. Ambassador Haley declared that the nations of the world have it within their power to further isolate, diminish, and, God willing, reverse the dangerous course of the North Korean regime. We must all do our part to make that happen.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.